You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights, down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. This is Annie, and I'm in the studio with Tabea and Anila. Good morning, folks.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, and you say that you're always waiting for my weather report because I get on my treadley and get all across town to get to this station. Well, it's spooky out there because, of course, we all know it's been uncharacteristically warm, and, of course, everybody has been silly with the end of the year season. Everybody's happy for the year to be finally put to bed. So everyone's having fun out there each night. And in the morning, you get to see the debris. But and it's really warm still, but later on, and all the birds are going crazy. And later in the day, apparently, there's going to be lightning and a thunderstorm. So take your brolly if you're going anywhere. That's the weather report.
It was a really comprehensive one this morning.
It's just that it's really, really atmospheric out there. It's quite extraordinary.
Very strange weather.
Yeah.
I had to take my jumper on and off about four times.
Because you couldn't work out what you were actually doing. anyway, that's the banal aspects of the day. But now we're moving on to some of the headlines, and some of them are pretty disturbing. We might start with the fact that the US has decided that it's going to Shanghai a Venezuelan oil tanker. And what did they say, Anila, about that?
Well, they said, I can't find the quote immediately, but they essentially accused it of being the ship that was stolen as being a part of illicit oil trades that are part of funding terrorist activities between Iran and Venezuela. So another completely unsubstantiated claim. This one, perhaps even more outlandish than some of the drug claims. I would maybe not necessary to compare, equally as outlandish, I should say. They also have doubled down on moving in the direction of essentially undermining Venezuela's sovereignty and ownership of its own kind of assets and resources by sanctioning six more ships said to be carrying Venezuelan oil a day after they seized the tanker. What sanctions mean specifically remains unclear, but the US press secretary did say, quote, we're not going to stand by and watch sanctioned vessels sail the seas with black market oil, the proceeds of which will fuel narco-terrorism of rogue and illegitimate regimes around the world. So, you know, a not so subtle nod to the seizure not being a one-off occurrence. And they've also levied sanctions at Maduro and some of his family members following the seizure as well. So, yeah, definitely an escalation in the Venezuela situation over the last week.
Especially with the Nobel Prize winning candidate Machado saying that she fully supports this action, saying that it's a very necessary step to confront Maduro's quote-unquote criminal regime.
I don't know why anyone thinks she's not, you know, a pallbearer of peace. It's crazy.
Well, it just shows you that the Nobel Prize is not something that is worthy of attention.
No.
It's obviously deeply...
How embarrassing for them.
The Amnesty International has put out a piece saying that sustainable peace requires international justice for all victims of all crimes in Israel and the OPT. The states must demonstrate their commitment to international justice to ensure genuine accountability for victims of war crimes, crimes against humanity and genocide for all those in the occupied Palestinian territories, OPT, and in Israel, says Amnesty International, following the recent conclusion of the International Criminal Court's Assembly of States Parties in The Hague. A similar theme. I just thought it was a similar theme. Mm.
And as we talk about summer arriving here, it's winter in Gaza, and winter storms batter Gaza. From drop site news, at least 12 Palestinians have been killed or have gone missing in Gaza over the past 24 hours as torrential rains, high winds and flooding batter the enclave, according to the government media office. At least 13 homes have collapsed and more than 27,000 tents sheltering the displaced have been swept away by flash floods, either submerged by water or torn apart by strong winds. Civil defence teams are struggling to respond to hundreds of distress calls. The office said that more than 1.5 million displaced Palestinians in Gaza are at risk, and the UN's International Organisation for Migration said in a statement that basic toolkits, sandbags and water pumps have not been allowed into Gaza due to, quote, long-standing access restrictions by Israel. These materials are critical for repairing and reinforcing shelters against continued rainfalls and mitigating floods in sites.
If we come closer to home, there was a large amount of information around the rising levels of death in custody, black death in custody, that was highlighted this week since the Royal Commission. From an article put out by Freedom Socialists, the 1983 death of Yin Jabadi, teenager John Pat, at the hands of a racist state was a watershed moment. Despite multiple witnesses seeing five off-duty cops brutally assault the 16-year-old and an all-white jury acquitted the police officers, accepting their claims they were acting in self-defence. This injustice sparked the formation of the Committee to Defend Black Rights, a First Nations-led group campaigning to end deaths in custody. Relatives of those who had lost loved ones crisscrossed the country to speak at public meetings, rallies and in the media, turbocharging a grassroots media movement which finally compelled the setting up of the 1987 Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. Now, if we move to the present, more than 600 First Nations people have died in custody since the Royal Commission, and this is clearly not okay.
And I think further to the relevancy of those findings, last week we had the Tasmanian Custodial Inspector Dr. Grant Davies' review released, Security Contractor Transport of Young People in Custody, Safeguarding Review 2025. It found that there has been, surprise, surprise, mistreatment of youth in custody as they're being transported between facilities. There's been a recent report of a young person who was being transported having their head covered with their own t-shirt, creating an improvised spit hood while their hands were handcuffed behind their back. This is a quote from Jake Smith, the Tasmanian Aboriginal Legal Services Chief Executive. The use of a spit hood or the use of an improvised spit hood is completely unacceptable. It contravenes United Nations Conventions on the Rights of the Child. It's dangerous and dehumanising. All children and young people deserve to feel safe and supported and should be, no matter where they are, and particularly in the care of the Tasmanian government, its contractors and service providers.
Yes, that's exactly right. Before we get to more positive news, you may not have noticed, but the Albanese government has given the green light to five new offshore exploration areas in the Otway Basin. It was announced just before the gas market review, and this tender shows Labor is gearing up to increase supply rather than fix the crisis. The Greens, local Greens, The Greens have slammed the Albanese government for handing out new ocean acreage to their donor mates in the fossil fuel industry to exploit in the time of climate emergency. Labor's disgraceful decision has nothing to do with everyday Australians and everything to do with the state capture of our government by fossil fuel corporations. Australia is the second biggest exporter of fossil fuels in the world after Russia, yet Labor has no plan to deal with our exports and is content with 56% of all Australia's gas being exported without paying any royalties or resource rent tax. That's $170 billion. That's $170 billion worth of free gas over the next 5 years for big gas companies. And as we lead, it's like a Christmas present of death, really, isn't it?
That's one way of putting it. I feel like I'd like to finish off with a bit of positive news to cleanse our palates after, as you've said, a Christmas present of death. We've had climate protesters winning a groundbreaking class action lawsuit this week against Victorian police over their use of pepper spray. This was the first ever class action against Victoria police related to the excessive use of, I'm going to pronounce this terribly, Olearison capsicum or OC spray. The presiding judge awarded the plaintiff, Jordan Brown, $54,000 in damages, recognising both the physical and psychological harm caused by Victoria Police's actions. Brown said in a statement following the ruling that, quote, putting up a banner protesting against the expansion of mining companies and technologies that destroy the planet should never be a reason for police to come in with OC spray. Pretty sensible, I would say.
But also, going back to the Victorian police failed to prove that it was in self-defence, mm-hmm. that they felt threatened by the demonstrators. Anybody who was at IMARC would underline that. It was pretty outrageous, actually.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm actually surprised, to be honest, that it's the first case of its kind, because having been along to some of these protests, very hard to understand where OC spray would ever be an appropriate response to protesters.
Oh, yeah, yeah, but also the gleeful way that they spread it right across everybody's face and also won't even attack. I mean, I've seen it actually attacking the medical crew that are there to help people when they get it in their eyes. So, of course, there isn't any way of actually getting it out of people's faces. It's quite focused. Quite
hopefully
focused.
Marks the beginning of a bit more pushback against wanton violence.
Yes, coming from the state. Well, you're on Solidarity Breakfast and you're with Annie, Anila and Tabia.
The state Labor government has begun works on demolishing Melbourne's 44 public housing towers to be replaced with private housing. Already hundreds of residents have been displaced, often into unsuitable homes under duress. The tower at 12 Holland Court, Flemington, has become a Homes Victoria work site, while the families still living in the building are being treated appallingly. Join Save Public Housing supporters in solidarity with residents. Weekdays 7 to 9am and 4:30 to 6:30pm as we engage with passing traffic to make some noise and show Jacinta Allen that the demolition of public housing is unacceptable. Signs and banners provided or bring your own. There's power in numbers, so see you out on Racecourse Road at the front of 12 Holland Court, Flemington, 7 to 9am or 4:30 to 6:30pm. Check Save Public Housing Instagram page for weekly updates. Save Public Housing is a 3CR supporter.
You're on Solidarity Breakfast with Tabia, Annie and Anila. And to reinforce that message, there's a rave for the towers. Residents Frequency Studio Artists, 4pm to 8pm, Friday the 19th. You can go to Harmsworth Park. That's Harm with an S and Worth Park, Collingwood, and partake in music and food by the community for the community. It sounds like a really lovely thing to do leading up to the festive season. Rave for the towers. We're going to move to Voices for Palestine, and I'm going to give you a trigger warning. This is actually quite a upsetting piece of audio. It comes from Vivian from Climate Action. Their show is on Monday nights at 5 on 3CR. But she had this on that show. So this is something that reinforces the terrible nature of things for Palestinians at the moment, and the fact that winter is approaching.
You heard about the Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh from Runa Khan. Next door neighbour Myanmar continues what the UN describes as ethnic cleansing against civilians and genocide. If we drill a bit deeper, Rakhine State holds oil and gas fields which produce 20 million cubic metres of climate-changing gas per day. It's mostly exported to China in the Sino-Myanmar pipeline. Thus, China can bypass the Straits of Malacca by using ports in Rakhine State. It's a key area in the Belt and Road project. Does it sound familiar? Genocide. Oil and gas. Economic interests. This takes us to Gaza, where offshore gas is also a factor in the horror story that has seen Gaza crushed since 2023. Here is Mr. Shamik Badra speaking at a public meeting at Green Left offices in Sydney this year. It was a meeting in connection with the Rising Tide Climate Action Group, and you will hear how they are in solidarity with Palestine and against the Australian export of coal to Israel.
Last night, I met a family in Gaza who came to Sydney, and I was in discussion. I want to update to know the details about the situation, and they told me the situation became so dangerous after the genocide, and they are talking about things people, perhaps media, are not interested or didn't cover that in the media. Like, the children were talking how the sewage water, like, were in the tents everywhere, especially when it's raining, then the sewage with water mixed together, which is so dangerous. They reminded me about the situation regarding how the bodies, the dead bodies in the streets everywhere, because no one, and it's not easy to bury them, and how the dogs, cats, rats, like, eating their bodies. This is so dangerous about the environment and about the smell of these bodies. And I remember some people told me, you are lucky that you found someone to bury your father in this genocide. Otherwise, the cats and dogs can eat his body. So we are talking about terrible situation regarding affect not only about human beings, also affect the environment in general. White phosphorus. I remember when I was in Gaza how they were bombed by phosphorus. It was burning human flesh, burning trees, burning soil. Like, it make farmland unusable. It poison water. It stays in the environment for years. This is not just war, it's ecocide. Now, during this genocide, Israel has bombed greenhouses and farms. Thousands of animals have died, not only from bombs, but from hunger and thirst. There is no food, no water, no plants left. Even if there are, if there is water, it's not clean. It's terrible. You can't imagine now there is no trees. Then I asked my friends, they told me no trees, because people, Palestinians, forced to cut these trees in order to make food and to make fire to when this cold weather. Everything destroyed in Gaza. It's important to focus also about the bodies under the rubbles. A lot of people were under the rubbles, around 15 or to 20,000 under the rubbles, their body under the rubbles. They didn't pass away quickly. It took time to pass away. My brother and his family were one of these people who were under the rubbles. And behind it all, gas. Gas fields lie just off the coast of Gaza. This war is also a war of control of land and resources for domination of the Middle East environment and economy. That's why struggle for Palestine is a part of the climate struggle. Because environmental justice means fighting colonialism. Because the Israeli occupation doesn't just target people, it targets earth itself. It destroys land, trees, and seas, and the sea. It destroys any possibility of life. And the Western countries support Israel, especially America, with bombs, with money, and they are silenced and protect Israeli occupation. This is what imperialism look like. But I am here with hope, because around the world, people are waking up. Palestine Solidarity is now the largest sustained anti-war movement in history. Many of you support the Freedom Flotilla, not launched by Palestinians, but by activists, some of them climate activists, including Greta Thunberg, who see Palestine as a part of the same fight. These activists brought food and baby medicine from Yola, not weapons. They stood for life, for environment justice, for Gaza children, for the world where no child is poisoned by war, by pollution, or by poverty. So today I want to ask, how do we build common goals and common struggles? How do we make sure that environmental justice means justice for Palestinians too? How do we join forces across oceans, across movements, to fight for a world where no child is bombed and no land is poisoned? This is not justice about Gaza. It's about all of us. If we stay silent while bombs fail on children, while water is poisoned, while trees and farms are burned, then we are allowing this destruction to continue. But we are not silent. We are here to say enough is enough. Palestinians deserve life, safety, and dignity like anyone else in the world. The earth deserves to be protected and not destroyed by war. There can be no climate justice without justice for Palestine, no peace without freedom, no future without decolonization. Let's stand together for life, for land, for liberation. Let's build this struggle together. Thank you.
بقوة السلاح. تحت احجار وياسمين تعربش على الحيطان القدس بيوت وشوارع حارات تشهد عاللي صار حوطوها بجيش وحواجز وحاصروها بالجدار أخدوها دمروها واغتالوا حلم كل الناس غيروها
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
You're on Solidarity Breakfast, and we've got a live guest. It's unbelievable. Hello, Hamish Sawyer. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me, Annie.
Yeah, and you've come in from Linden New Art.
That's correct.
Yes, and of course, if you're an old stick like me, you know Linden. It's a beautiful Victorian mansion that's just up from Ackland Street, the action in Ackland Street. Go up the hill past McDonald's and you will find it.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. And it's got an exhibition at the moment called Coral Futures.
Yeah, so the exhibition looks at coral as a material and a metaphor for everything that's going wrong in the world, but the way that it's such a vital and connecting subject material for thinking about not just climate change and the impacts on the Great Barrier Reef, but it's sort of the way it intersects with larger sort of cultural, economic, social issues.
Okay, and you have relocated to, it's not so chilly anymore. It's really warm outside, but Melbourne, and you've come from, you used to live up north, right? So this is a this is a collaboration with a northern...
It's a collaboration with the University of Sunshine Coast. I did live in Cairns, though, Gimoy Cairns, and I was working at Northsight, which is a contemporary art organisation. And so that was really when I was up there for a couple of years, in that specific location, thinking about... And being in close proximity to the reef and so becoming acquainted with the practices of artists. Although, funnily enough, a number of the artists in the exhibition are actually from Melbourne. So it's quite a popular subject, coral, for contemporary artists. And this exhibition isn't, or doesn't pretend to be exhaustive, but there's, it covers the practices of five individual artists and then an art centre from the Torres Strait Arab. So it's it gives an insight and I hope the intention of it is to be poetic and speculative. It's a very heavy issue, but I think one of the great things about art is that it makes us look at issues, complex issues like that in thoughtful and imaginative ways.
And there's First Nations as well as Correct. Settler artists.
Correct. So, yeah, so Arab Arts, which is in the Torres Strait Islands, so at the very top of the Great Barrier Reef, and they are an arts centre that work predominantly with ghost nets, which are the fishing line and other plastics which are trapped in the sea and kill sea life, particularly turtles, or sort of sit in the ocean and break down to form microplastics. But they take this collected plastic and transform it into really whimsical, quite engaging works of art, which speak to the importance of the reef and sea life to their culture, their traditions, but also their way of living. Like they're literally living on the reef, so their survival is dependent on the reef survival as well. So I think the idea of them taking this really harmful material and transforming it into you know, work which tells these important stories is a really wonderful and powerful thing.
You're the curator of the show.
Correct.
So what did you have in mind, or what were you trying to achieve by choosing this specific kind of artists that have been invited to exhibit, but also the types of art that are on display?
Yeah, of course. So as I said, over time working in Cairns and obviously being in proximity with art centres like Erib and seeing that work firsthand, but being aware of other practices, so artists that I've worked with previously in different contexts, like Marion Tubbs, who's an artist based in on Bundjalung country in northern New South Wales, who made this really fantastic video work about 5 or 6 years ago called Nervous Systems, which is sort of like a video assemblage of found material, found sound clips and ripped images from the internet to narrate the life cycle of coral. But then it sort of unfolds into this bigger picture, I guess, video essay where she's looking at the way in which coral intersects with so many other parts of life. The fact that in 2019, coral was the Pantone colour of the year, which is quite funny given the current this year's selection and the controversy that's caused. So,
what is this year's selection? Oh, I don't even.
It's a very white white. So they, it's like a snowflake white. It's yeah. So it's
gasp.
Yeah. So which has received a bit of a flack, quite rightly, but
weirdly political.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Like no politics in colour and no politics in sport. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Exactly. But it's you can't help but bring it in. So, and then other artists. So as I said, artists, Melbourne-based artists. So Nicholas Mangan, who's a very prominent, incredible artist who had a survey show at the Museum of Contemporary Art last year, has had this project called Core Correlations, looking at the reef as a kind of metaphor, you know, thinking about it as a barrier around the continent of Australia, but also as a metaphor for the Australian government's you know, policies around climate change and migration.
Why do you think so many artists, you know, outside of this exhibition bringing them together, have kind of organically come to be so interested in coral as a metaphor?
Maybe the organic bit.
That's a really good question, actually. I think thinking about it, it's such a high profile, highly visible symbol of the reef and what that means in terms of the tourism industry, for example. But it's such an extraordinary organism, animal. Mm-hmm. You think about the coral spawning on the reef, which is happening sort of imminently, and the way that people are just so drawn to it and as this sort of beautiful, otherworldly looking symbol of the reef and reef ecologies and the sustainability. And because it's under such threat, so things like coral bleaching, crown of thorns starfish, agricultural runoff, which is a huge problem. And so it's almost, it's like the canary down the coal mine.
Yeah, it is. The fascinating thing about this is that because of the nature of human-centric and economy based rationalism that we're caught in a sort of a bubble, the things that happen in nature which inform our life actually are much more complex than that storyline actually gives out. So an exhibition like this actually allows humans to unleash the thing that humans are actually good at, which is art and culture.
Yeah, and that's absolutely right. And in terms of the thinking behind the show, you know, the climate crisis can seem you know, something that's insurmountable, or where we're just removed from it, right? Like we see all the floods and droughts and bushfires through a screen, media or, you know, the news. And so
it's over there.
And by focusing on one individual species and starting to sort of think about all the ways that it's actually connected with our daily lives and how it intersects with our lives, you know, it sort of empowers people to understand that they actually do have the capacity to do something as well.
Yeah.
On the theme of making climate change action kind of relevant to people's lived experience, do you have any thoughts about the significance of having an exhibition like this in a place like Melbourne, which can feel very remote from some of these environmental issues?
That's a really great point. And I think when I came to Lyndon and I pitched this exhibition, you know, obviously we're by the bay, so we are connected to the water. It's summer, that time of year when a lot of people come to St Kilda. It is very removed, like geographically, conceptually. There's one work I just want to mention before we run out of time, and that's a film. It's a feature-length film, experimental documentary by Rachel O'Reilly, who's a queer settler, artist and researcher, looking at the history of the Save the Reef campaign. So, you know, back in the 60s, good old Sir J.B. Occupeterson granted all these licenses.
Yeah, the Great Destroyer.
Yeah. So, and so it was actually a couple of Anglo-European, Australian artists. So Judith Wright, a poet, an environmentalist, and John Boost, who was originally from Melbourne, who sort of spearheaded those original campaigns to stop the drilling of the reef.
Yeah.
And it was actually the trade unions that physically stopped it because they wouldn't do it. Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah, they wouldn't let the boats go out.
They saved the world.
Yeah. So but it also you know, I guess revisits it to think about, well, you know, where were the traditional owners? Where are First Nations people? Because, of course, you know, if you look at Juru country around Mission Beach, where the campaign was focused, they'd all been moved to Palm Island. Yeah, in the early 20th century.
Yeah, they took their country and they put them on an island.
Yeah, so it looks at, it addresses those gaps as well in the story, but I think it's incredibly informative and in a way the film does a lot of heavy lifting, but I think it's really, it's a really fascinating piece of work, which sort of orientates the more sort of speculative, creative works in the exhibition. But it's a really compelling film.
Yeah, fantastic stuff. And there's some hands-on things. We've arrived at having a conversation with you halfway through the exhibition period time frame. So it started on November the 15th, but it goes to February the 1st.
Yes.
And you had a variety of different workshops, which is fantastic, real hands-on stuff, how to make plastic useful.
Yeah. And that can, I should say, there is an opportunity that continues throughout the show. We have an activity space in the exhibition where you can contribute to this sort of slowly growing, evolving reef that's made out of reclaimed, recycled plastic. So that runs throughout the exhibition.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you very much for coming in and talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I think it's just so great.
Good lawa and then hangalia good lawa memena magara
G'day, my name is Margie Thorpe.
You are listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 on your dial.
A weak solidarity, Ricky T. Mr. When just when we thought global capitalist behemoth Dexploits might have buried its head in the sand for a while, following that scandal over producing an ultra-expensive report for government containing barely one accurate statement or fact, found to have been delegated to AI, no. Dexploits this week offered the government the solution to its debt problem, including increasing and broadening the good old GST, so we pay more for everything we buy. Now, we've mentioned this is a positive, contributing to social equality, as the poorest of the poor pay exactly the same tax as the filthiest rich or the filthy rich, like, say, our JIDA. A morale fillip to cheer up the poorest of the mob and boost their sense of importance. Although, as an ignoramus in matters to do with the greatest little economic order of them all, unlike great practitioners like Dextroids, I've had some difficulty working out Dextroids' claim that its plan is to take the burden off working-class true blue Aussies. By increasing... No, there's got to be a simple explanation. Governments are finding clever ways of addressing that debt problem, although some say it's more a perception than a problem that governments can just print money anyway. That aside, our state socialists, for instance, plan to slash thousands of public service jobs, human collateral, including axing lots of government bodies like Vic Health, which makes such a lot of sense as it's not likely to put more pressure on the rest of the health system. While, as private hospitals also complain they're not making a big enough killing, financial killing that is, Big Supremo Anthony Albanese has declared government is not in the business of bailing out the private sector. Interesting that, so billions to the great resource behemoths, particularly to their smelting subsidiaries, is not bailing out. While the National Reconstruction Fund has come up with $45 million real figure for Arnett's profit biscuits and $36 million real figure for Patty, salt, sugar and fat foods, makers of, among other things, other contributions to national health, 4 and 20 pies. Again, a wise investment, because we can be sure Arnett's profit and Patty's salt, sugar and fat make a major contribution to the health crisis. Salt, sugar and trans fat upon trans fat, to crack a very, very bad joke, not worth a cracker, but a cracker of a plan. Pure financial genius, really. Anthony and the team are considering privatising, flogging off the Air Traffic Control and Air Safety Agency, and leasing them back. See, they pay you to buy the public asset, and then over the journey, you give them that and lots more to lease back what you own in the first place. It's been one of the great success stories of neoliberalism, as consumers picking up the bills will attest. All because, as we're told, the private sector is so much more efficient than the bloated hand of the public sector. And anyway, what does safety matter when it comes to air traffic control and aircraft? Passengers will feel so much more secure. And as a large number of writers, artists and academics have expressed alarm at mooted changes for the state library, seems they've got it wrong. It's not, the library said, a reduction of professional capability. It is a redeployment of skills to better meet contemporary demand. Well, that's clear, whatever it meant. So why are staff, their evil union and supporters, holding a protest rally at the library at noon today? Surely their boss's word is enough, whatever it meant. Speaking of expenses and caring employers, SBS Telly has run a series on disengaged Pacific Island workers brought here for fruit picking. Disengaged because they couldn't survive on what was left of their so-called wages after their bosses, their caring employers and or labour hire agents, same thing, extracted all sorts of expenses, and under the terms of their so-called employment, they cannot change caring employers, so they disengaged and are left in limbo. Thankless, thankless workers. The minister, Pat Conlemroy, first time I've heard him say anything other than getting excited about train killing, said True Blue Aussie was opposed to any exploitation of workers. Very reassuring. and asked whether the government would alter the rules to allow workers to change employers, gave a classic example of polyverbal calisthenics without answering the question. So the disengaged are left in limbo with exactly nothing but the assurance True Blue Aussie does not condone their exploitation. I'll be homeless for Christmas. Not homeless, but gearing up yet again for another happy, happy family's Christmas, the aforementioned Gina. What a fun, fun day Christmas must be at Gina's, but this year, oh so sadly, with a dark cloud hanging over the celebrations. See, she is constructing a multi-million giant Perth headquarters for her caring business conglomerate, well, the iron ore bit in particular. We reported some time ago the council had decided a heritage protection on the site no longer applied to facilitate Gina's latest contribution to the urban skyscape. Speaking of which, the sky, therein lies the dark cloud. Gina wants a helipad on the roof to make it just that little bit easier to get in and out when she's not socialising at Mar-a-Lago, as is her right to get in and out, and the same bloody council which threw out the heritage order has rejected the helipad, claiming it would be too noisy and disruptive, affect the area's amenity. Where are they coming from? A missed opportunity for Perth to cement its reputation as a growing, globally recognised hub for international mining and business investment, Gina bemoaned. Oh, what an opportunity missed, poor Gina. But she will consider her options, so I think we can expect big end-of-town lawyers to be rubbing their greedy hands together, eyes spinning like cash registers. Greedy nonsense. Like that class action by victims of the Brazilian catastrophe when a BHP bloody huge profits bloody huge polluter dam burst, the environment still a disaster. The lawyers said they would claim 15% of any settlement. The case settled without going to court for just over $100 million, and what do we know? The poor lawyers reassessed their position and discovered they were worth half the settlement. Bad luck for the actual victims. Not that bloody huge has been rushing to sort out the mess. Successfully sorting out the world's mess, US of the UN of the US of the world, big supremo Donald Trump or the poor, just mopping up the conflagrations he resolved way back on January 20, day one. Although Donald is a little frustrated with Ukraine supremo No Thanks He Give Me More, who refuses to accept Donald's generous offer that he surrender, when Donald knows there can be no doubt Ukraine is the aggressor, giving Vlad the invader no choice but to invade, because there it is, right next door, with all those resources. While the slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation in the non-peoples on land is a fair bit less than it was before the ceasefire, and could be even less, but that the non-land non-people act suspiciously like walk in the streets, giving Zion no choice but to slaughter, destroy, genocide and starve. And in a telling fight for world peace, Donald made another giant stride toward his cherished Nobel Peace Prize by seizing a Venezuelan oil tanker on the open seas, and for the most justifiable of reasons. Because, he explained, presumably the biggest because ever. Although, okay, a slightly fuller explanation, a touch more detail mightn't have hurt, but this is Donald after all, and Venezuela also has a few resources, doesn't it? And top marks for sycophancy to FIFA, the soccer world body, which argues we must keep politics out of sport, brackets when it suits it, for awarding Donald a peace medal. It makes Anthony Albanese's bootlicking look very average. Meanwhile, we can but assume that after 35 years, Anthony and the team must be very close to adopting recommendations of the Her Most Gracious Majesty's Commission into Terra Nullius non-land, non-people deaths in custody. While meanwhile, the deaths go on and on and on. Somehow, the voice referendum has reduced the socialists to an invertebrate, but not in looking after themselves. As the hoo-ha over our selfless police exploiting their... utilising the little expenses and benefits they are entitled to, over and above their not insignificant salaries, any suggestion the whole thing is a bit over the top can be scotched by that collective explanation, "We all do it," highlighted this week as the hayseed and sheepshed's Bridget Macon MC seems to have forgotten that since her sports rorts, she is not only not the sports minister anymore, but isn't even in government. As was revealed, she has run up a cool $30,000 bill for flights, accommodation and chauffeur services while attending 21 sports junkets since. Junkets? Sorry again, invitations. Doubtless within the guidelines. Interesting juxtapositioning, True Blue Aussie Capitalist Review P1 Tuesday. Next to an article listing the thousands the current Minister Annika Wells' offers run up, clearly within the guidelines, big headline, Treasurer flags tough budget calls, / services for the plebs. Well, someone's got to pay for it all. After all, Annika's little dedications to duty are far from the top of the expenses list, the media has reported. Nonetheless, Annika, we asked Annika, the guidelines we assume were drawn up independently? Absolutely, very independently. By whom? Well, by us. So you drew them up independently for yourselves. Too right, but this shows we really care. Arising out of this, Annika, there are suggestions, just maybe, the guidelines should be reviewed. So should the guidelines be changed? Good God, no, they're perfect. They fill the bill perfectly, so to speak. Thanks, Annika. A pleasure. Must check. Can I claim expenses for an interview? A gang of myopic goody-goodies with no respect for authority or proper processes raided a Port Phillip Council meeting Thursday night, but thankfully did not deter the altruistic burghers from solving the homelessness problem by declaring it illegal for the homeless to be homeless. There, problem solved with the stroke of a pen. Further, if they persist with their criminal behaviour, the gentle thugs, or sorry, are maintaining security officers, will confiscate their opulent, meagre belongings. Which brings us to a similar situation which may or may not have occurred a couple of thousand years ago. A couple, including a bloke who's followed the line his partner was a virgin, impregnated by a spirit, and about to give birth, found themselves homeless in a place called Bethlehem, forced to give birth in a stable, a mangy manger. Not sure whether or not the authorities who denied them a roof over their heads confiscated their meagre belongings. Whatever, we're about to celebrate the birth, true or false, of the dear baby Jesus, making it understandable that a wise Her Honour ruled effectively that the Tiwi Island people's relationship to their waterways is superstition, witchcraft, that the rites of Santosas the prophets to pollute those waters on the dear baby Jesus born of a virgin given right to prophet altar must prevail. Anthony Albanese said it was a disgrace that 2,000 years ago, authorities could not provide shelter for the homeless. Thank God, he thanked God. We've come a long way in 2,000 years. And while February seems a long way away, bad news, listener, you'll think time flies when you gasp, oh no, he's back, when the week that was returns with more of this nonsense. Meanwhile, enjoy the festivities, keep safe, and let's keep the struggle going. Good morning.
Hopefully we can protect everything that's worth protecting on country and keep all warmongers out.
Well, I won't back down.
Coogatha elder Aunty Sue Hasseldine is fighting to protect her country from Southern Launch's rocket testing range. Southern Launch's collaborations with international weapons companies such as Thales, as well as the Australian Defence Force, are threatening sacred sites, endangered animals and unique ecosystems. Join West Mallee Protection, letter writing calling on key decision makers to get Southern Launch off Coogatha country. For more information, visit West Mallee Protection on Instagram. West Mallee Protection is a 3CR supporter.
And I won't back down.
Hi, I'm Ahmed from Fidro Primary School, and you're listening to Community Radio on 3CR.
And you're back with the Solidarity Breakfast team on this fine morning, and we're being joined by the CFMEU local correspondent, Amelia. How are you?
Yeah, good, thank you.
Yeah, we've been getting some updates about CFMEU from the members' point of view, And thank you very much for coming in and talking to us in this trying time for a member of a mighty union that's now under administration. How's it feeling for you on site to feel that your union hasn't got your back in the same way?
Well, I think, like, I'm concerned about the union losing its capacity to be as staunch organisers as they have been in the past. I think that our industry is so dangerous that actually sometimes we need delegates and organisers who are really willing to push the rules. So, you know, like, I hear from delegates and members about the bureaucracy and the paperwork that you have to jump through to really get companies pulled up on safety issues. And sometimes that takes a long time, but unfortunately, if you go through that process and you're waiting and waiting and waiting for approval to address safety issues or to shut down a job, in that meantime, someone can be really seriously injured or killed.
Well, so, we've seen it, haven't we?
Yeah, recently. Yeah, exactly. And I think the work that CFMEU has done over the decades has really meant that, you know, as construction workers, we have quite a good standard of living. We have, like, a really pretty decent pay and conditions. When you look at construction across the world, it's one of the best in the world. But there's a concern that that's going to start rolling back. And while we're in a cost of living crisis and a housing crisis, I think this is really going to hurt members.
You've heard that some of the bigger worksites companies are not paying certain elements that they should have been paying in the EBA.
Yeah, I think right from the beginning of administration, we've seen a lot of bosses trying to take advantage of the situation, and we're seeing it a lot now as well. So I've heard of companies only paying time and a half for overtime instead of double time, which is part of our EBA agreements, that all overtime should be double time at least. So yeah, it's getting to the point where it's going to start hurting members in their pockets. It's going to start pushing members into more risky jobs and more risky situations. And that's really worrying that perhaps things are rolling back a bit.
Obviously, strong union representation is particularly important for women on work sites. Could you talk a bit more about, you know, from the perspective of a woman on these sites, how some of these changes affect people specifically from a kind of gendered perspective?
Yeah, so unfortunately our branch now is at the point where we've lost all but one of our female industrial organisers. Which is,
I mean,
really,
they've been working so hard to build that up.
Yeah, it's really devastating because it takes a long time to build that kind of leadership. And in the space of less than, well, just over a year, that's really been decimated. But not only that, it really affects the union's capacity to build women's leadership for the future. So, for example, there was a program being rolled out in the ACT in Queensland to do with safe and respectful workplaces for women. And that program was, like, gaining a lot of success.
And then, it was very grassroots, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was developed by women in the union.
It wasn't all namby-pamby meetings off-site.
No, exactly. And that program, they had developed it and were rolling it out, and bosses were paying for it. They were the ones paying for the members to go and attend this training. And then when we went into administration, that was scrapped, and it was meant to be rolled out in Victoria and New South Wales next, and it never had been. So that was really disappointing. And then the administrator came up with his plan for our union, And one of those, one of the parts of his plan was to roll out a program of his own, which would have cost $5.4 million of members' money.
It was run by the ACTU.
Yeah, and it would have been just for union officials, so not for workers on site, which is where we really need to make the cultural changes. So with this program that he developed, he didn't consult any CFMEU women. None of us even knew that he was planning this. We all were informed of this plan when he stuck it up on the website with no prior notification. And in response to that, CFMEU women across all branches voted up a statement that we put out. Unfortunately, it wasn't able to be put out on CFMEU socials or the CFMEU website, which has never happened before. Like, the women's committees and women's networks across our branches have never really had to ask for permission to speak up about an issue. We voted up to reject his plan, and, you know, unfortunately as well, there's a lot of training that would have been happening for women in our union that would have been done in partnership with Trades Hall, which we're no longer allowed to participate in. So Trades Hall runs programs like the Anna Stewart Memorial Project, which is not available to CFMEU women anymore. So we've been talking a bit about developing our own training programs for women, but it seems to me that that's a long slog. Like, it's going to take a lot of time to rebuild that.
Yeah, and this is for you as a working woman, as part of the trades. It's a bit like saying, oh, we're going to change things for education in the future, except children can't wait. But, you know, people who are working now can't wait. And there was a plan, there was action happening. And now with the administration, it would appear that they're much more focused on other things other than members' needs. That's a reflection on my part. One of the things that coming out of this, you mentioned the comms. At the Victorian branch, the comms have all been closed down. That's the communication sector at Victorian branch CFMU has now been closed down.
Yeah, unfortunately, we've lost our entire comms team now. We've been told that the comms for Victorian branch, we will no longer have our own comms team, and that will be handled by the national branch. And unfortunately, we also hear that work will be outsourced to a company that is often used by the ACTU, and that unfortunately is very heavy on its use of AI. So a lot of us are not really happy about that because, like, for one, we don't want to see a loss of jobs for people in the creative industries. Like, Mia are running a massive campaign to do with AI because it really affects their members. And also, our own comms team were people that us as members could trust. So we could trust them to put out our stories and take care of it.
But it's also proximity. They're unclipping the information from the source, and they're creating it and massaging it into a generalised statement, because this is our area of expertise, a generalised statement instead of the true voices of members.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, at the moment, recently we've been doing a lot of work around the 16 days of activism against gendered violence. And having a comms team that members could trust meant that, like, women within the union could express our stories of what we experience on site and the issues that we face to these people that we know and trust. And not just that we trust them with our stories, but we trust them to use our stories in a way that shows the nuances of those issues. So, like, yeah, we might face issues on site with gender discrimination or harassment, but we also love our CFMEU brothers. And expressing those stories is not to, like, crap
it's not
on
to
them.
To beat them about the head.
No,
yeah.
It's
about change, positive
exactly,
change.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. And so I'm not sure what's going to happen with that now.
Okay, and the other thing is that there's been more targeted removals of organisers.
Yeah, so we're now up to at least 11 organisers who have been gone. But we've also throughout this process, we've lost people across nearly every department. So we've lost people in our legal department. We've lost our comms team. We've lost people in our EBA department. So it's not just the organisers. It's across the board.
So they're withering the Victorian branch.
Yeah. And, like, the administrator's powers are so, so exorbitant. Like, he can suspend, remove, expel, disqualify any member, delegate or official. Members can be expelled for up to 5 years.
Are there any requirements for why someone would be expelled or dismissed, or is it kind of free, kind of?
Is it a king administrator?
So under the legislation, it kind of talks about the process that admin has to take in order to make these changes and decisions. But all it says is that he will decide the process in which he expels people or removes people, or in, like, how he changes our union rules, how he also has control of the construction and general division's voting rights. There's nothing in there about the process that he should be taking. He decides the process, which is a really
so
big
a lot
problem.
Of power concentrated in one person's hand is the impression that I'm getting.
Yeah, yeah, with no oversight.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, he for the very little oversight that there's meant to be, there isn't it. So he's meant to provide financial reports every 6 months. And he consistently fails to deliver them on time, sometimes like up to 6 months late. And it's not real clear from those reports where he's spending the money.
Yeah, we were listening to your speech from the May Day rally earlier this year where you talked about this very thing. And probably I imagine those reports have still not yet seen the light of day of where the members' money have come from May.
So there have been reports released, but they were extremely, extremely late and they're really, really vague. So it's really difficult to discern, you know, how much money he's spending on things like Quartermentha, who's the accounting company that he's hired to audit the CFMEU, despite them not being qualified to audit an organization like the CFMEU.
What you're really saying is that what's good for one group of people is not good for another. So, for example, yep. CFMEU, it was considered that the CFMEU supporting the Port Melbourne Football Club was verging on corruption, while what we're watching the Ashes at the moment being played with a great big banking symbol on the front of the players' shirts.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I'm sure that bank's not being pushed into administration and being told that it's been corrupt in its sponsorship money.
No, of course not. And, I mean, there we can pull on so many examples of, like, bosses' organisations that exhibit, like, extreme levels of corruption and nothing is done about it. But
so
when
it's
comes
very
to
targeted.
When it comes to a working class organisation, then it's all guns ho. Yeah. And like with this legislation, I mean, it's disappointing to see some other trade unionists, particularly from like the ACTU and Trades Hall, who are backing administration, fail to see that this legislation is an attack on all of us. Like, anyone can be put under administration. And watching what's happening in Queensland, we can see that even just a change in a state-based government can have a huge impact. Queensland has experienced a tremendous amount of deaths on site. And that's the consequences.
It can be directly attributed to the weakening of the OH&S elements and the attacks on the unions, can't?
Yeah, and like with Queensland comrades, like we've seen like the Liberal government there roll back their best practices industry conditions, which really improved conditions on site. So one of the big things was clauses around adverse weather conditions.
Yeah, heat exhaustion.
Yeah, heat exhaustion, rain, lightning, humidity, all these things
that affect. Kill you.
Yeah, exactly. And like with heat stress, you know, it might not kill you on the job, but it might kill you a few years later. We've seen that with construction workers who worked for FIFA World Cup, that like they built the infrastructure in Qatar for the FIFA World Cup. They returned home and died a year later because of the effects of the heat stress.
It's just outrageous. It really is outrageous. And workers really need to band together. That's why you have your union. That's what they're supposed to be for. We have to finish because it's making me boil. But the other thing is Esther, one of your great organisers, she was in the Fair Work Commission recently. You've got a few things to talk about there.
Yeah, so Esther had her Fair Work hearing on Thursday. So we think that the hearing went really well. We're anticipating.
What were the issues? Tell people what.
So Esther was out in public at a cinema, and she had a run-in with reporter Nick McKenzie, who really kicked off all of this. And he's alleging that, you know, she did the wrong thing and
made him feel unsafe.
Yeah, yes. Poor Nick McKenzie being confronted by a CFMEU woman. I can see why that would be intimidating, of course. if you're not great with women, why a strong vocal woman would be intimidating. But so then Nick McKenzie called up the administrator.
And he's got a direct line.
Yeah, he does. And the next day she was a removed person. She like insisted that what he was saying is not true. But that didn't matter. There was no investigation into the matter. So she's appealed to the Fair Work Commission to be taken off the removed persons list. So that's what that hearing was about. And funnily enough, the Age tried to put in a suppression order on this case.
Wow.
So,
well, they're scaredy cats, aren't they? Yeah. Scared are they? They want to sling the mud, but they can't take it.
No, exactly. So now we're just waiting on the ruling for that case. She also has a high court case as well that's in the process. But hopefully we'll get a ruling for this case and hopefully she'll be put off the removed persons list.
Yeah. Thanks very much for coming in and giving us a lowdown on what's going on from a member's point of view about the CFMEU Victorian branch. Hopefully things improve over time, but obviously the struggle continues.
Yes, it does.
And you're part of, and if people are interested, they should seek out the organisation, a collective of community members, Defend Unions, Defend the CFMEU. They'd love you to be part of the fight back.
Public transport's great.
What's not great is that unless you've got a radio with you, you can't listen to 3CR when you're on it.
Until now. The Community Radio Plus app lets you listen to us wherever you are.
Get on board and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
And you're back on Solidarity Breakfast. We're coming up to the end of the show, but before we go, we're going to talk to Duncan, who's got a report about the shameful idea of cutting the workforce at the State Library. G'day, Duncan. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Thanks for that introduction. Yeah, I'll speak a little bit on the proposed restructure that was put forward by the State Library. I think some of the details were lacking a bit of transparency, but one thing the workers could understand was it was going to result in a scrapping of key public-facing roles, replacing some frontline workers with self-service options, iPads, chatbots, AI functions, more taxpayer money into expensive digital innovation projects. There's going to be a significant reduction in the number of public access computers, and ultimately cutting the number of reference librarians from about 21 or 25 at the moment down to 10, so a 50% reduction.
It's outrageous, isn't it? Who do they think they are? We want to start a file called, or a segment on this program called, Who Do They Think They Are?
I would just like to point out as well that kind of what you've just described is undermining some of the basic functions of a public library. Could you talk about how these changes limit the service that the library is there to provide?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the removal of the public access computers, I've personally got friends that have found those to be very useful, and then just seems a particularly cruel function there. And then in terms of the reference librarians, there's some 5 million books and files at the State Library. So you're bringing in a significant reduction of the staff that could engage with that. And
getting really rid of people who have immense expertise, like librarians.
Correct.
Are people who have studied for years.
But you see, also, there's another element to this. The government has an obligation to make it possible for its citizens to actually access its services. And since they've now gone online in a multivarious ways, all those people who actually don't have a proper internet access or computer access because they're poor have to be able to have public access computers, and they've been using libraries as the node for that communication with the public. So
yeah,
please explain.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you're totally right there. This is in the midst of some executive pay rises as well. You've had the demands for greater transparency around these changes and these supposed digital roles largely ignored. And millions of dollars are still being spent on these digital online projects. I think recently they've done an online exhibit on Ned Kelly. And, that's an important chapter of history, sure, but it's hard to see it as a priority when in the same term, you're trying to cut the staff so significantly and make the library a less welcoming and hospitable environment for people that use it on the daily, instead pushing them to engage with an online exhibition.
Core business. It's called core business.
Of course.
Recently in the news, it was we had a bit of an update. The library has backed down from some of these proposed changes because of the pushback. Could you tell us a bit more about the community response and how that was able to effectively get the library administration to change their mind?
Pull their head in.
Yeah, of course. I think, you know, the library tried to crunch some numbers on the cost savings, but it's always really hard to quantify just how much community and workers can unite and fight on things. So the community pushback has been really significant. I think thousands of names 15,000 maybe names on different petitions. You had open letters from various artists and literary figures. To add to that, worker pushback at the State Library has been incredibly solid and organised. And as a result, State Library Victoria has paused this restructure. I think a week ago, the Community and Public Sector Union, working with the State Library workers, organised a public rally. That's happening today. It is still going ahead.
12:30
at the State Library. And I think it's really important to show up, as is often the case. The State Library execs probably think that they can simply pause the implementation and come back later with further cuts. So while they've stepped back from it now, I think people really need to turn out and remind the executives what resistance looks like. And in terms of the members, the workers have led so much of the organising and resistance and really used the CPSU as a vessel. Members did the hard work and built the campaign and have delivered their counter demands. And this afternoon will mobilise a huge amount of the community to come and stand in solidarity.
And it's a testament to the work the CPSU has done, the membership of the CPSU has done in regaining control of their union and representing it, and being one of the first campaigns to end out the year. It's really nice to see that the community will still come out and support. We'll all be there recording.
Yeah, this is part of the recent CPSU's Victoria Works Because We Do campaign, which is trying to resist some incredibly significant cuts to the Victorian Public Service. As I said before, the State Library workers were leading and coordinating and organising, but the CPSU was a very receptive vessel through which to organise. As part of that broader campaign, and to speak to your point around member mobilisation, CPSU recently had a mass meeting and about 1,500 members dialed in and voted overwhelmingly to endorse the campaign and seemed understandably hyped by the newly invigorated union. Also, it's not just the State Library that's under the target. There's lots of other places. You've got a whole bunch of departments and statutory authorities and independent entities, such as Vic Health is another one.
Yeah, I know, they want to cut Vic Health.
Yeah, it's a health promotion fund that's been leading the way for 40 years. It's the first in the world, does long-term evidence-driven healthcare action and listens to the community rather than political cycles. And they're going to cut that as a cost-saving thing when their own federal government says that every dollar you spend in public health prevention saves you $14 on future health costs.
Well, thanks very much for giving us an update. And I must say that when you get to this situation, you have to think about the managers. I mean, maybe the government hasn't been doing its job.
Yeah, I hear there's five execs. Maybe we could hemorrhage some of those out.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, thanks very much. Be there at 12:30 at the State Library steps and be loud and proud. Thanks for talking to us this morning, Duncan.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that is a wrap. We're going to go out with Emma Donovan. Is there anything else you want to say, you guys?
Have a lovely Saturday and see you at the steps of State Library.
And take a brolly because there's going to be rain.
Listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.